It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. In the studio with me now with our Trails Report, Charlie Sturgis with Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Dry, dusty, but beautiful weather.
You got to love the weather. A little buggy up there in the Uintas, but wildflowers are coming out and things like that. But, yeah, as we were listening to the weather there, I think there's one dominating theme we can talk about for trail stuff right now is that for riding in these dusty conditions, especially on trails that are newer, this is one of the reasons one of our newer trails has not even been really officially opened, is as things get dusty, the corners crumble, you start to get that moon dust thing going. The best thing you can do is really try to control your speed and particularly control your braking. Those two things will just create more and more dust. And when we do get a rain, which in Utah is more likely a thunderstorm, all that dust material gets washed down the trail. So the less dust that we can create out there by kind of going a little bit slower, it helps a huge amount, especially on anything that's got a new cut in it. So where you up on Jenny's, where we have a few new parts reconnected, trail that we have in Round Valley and the stuff that we'll be doing up here in up off of the Crescent Lift area here shortly. All those things are going to be very sensitive to speed and sort of impact from speed. So let's be careful. Outside of that, it is gorgeous, but I would like to maybe bring up a subject today or maybe a little reminder for everybody out there. This week probably has been kind of a dominant week for me as far as people probably almost practically getting in my face about behavior on the trails. And, you know, I started to want to kind of give some excuses about, you know, all the things that we do. You know, Mountain Trails puts a lot of information out there. We have flyers in the shops. You know, we have various educational messages out on trailheads and kiosks. But, you know, it did come to me afterwards that this is really a community problem. It's not just a Mountain Trails issue, and that we all need to work on this one together. It's everything from issues of speed to just general politeness. I rode back from the hospital the other day coming up the rail trail, and almost nobody actually smiled or responded when I said hi. Maybe I'm just a disturbing guy. I don't know. But the long and short of it is it's our community. It's our trails. And I think locally we need to try to manage that as best we can. And I think in the next few weeks I'm going to be out there asking bike shops and promoters and probably even show up at city council and go, hey, you know, we need to get on top of this and get this message out through all the channels, including us individually, to make sure that our trail system is as pleasant as we want it to be. So let's not let this thing get away from us, because there's no question we're under pressure. We're super busy. A lot of that is super cool. Certainly businesses love it. We have lots of friends here that are enjoying themselves, but let's just make sure it's as enjoyable for everybody all the time.
Okay, and something we've talked about before, of course, is just kind of when you ring the bell, you say always ring it, even though it startles some people. At least it gives them a heads up that you're coming, huh?
Yeah, I think there's a point where what I found in my own life at this point is when I used to come up behind people and really quietly go, pardon me, they practically jump out of the skin. So in one sense, I find the bell more effective. Sometimes maybe ring it a little further back, but certainly make yourself noticed. And I think the other part of the confusion sometimes is especially if you're a rider or runner and you're overtaking someone who's maybe just hiking or has dogs, you're never really sure which way they're going to go. I mean, right of way is sort of this lost skill, I think, out there at times. We kind of forget that, you know, oncoming traffic, if you're going to be coming towards somebody, you stay to the right. And if you're passing somebody from behind, you basically pass on the left. So you should be able to, and hopefully what we want to do is start to get everyone to think about stepping to the right if you're going to be overtaken. And, of course, if you're the person overtaking them, it's best if you plan on staying to the left. There's no hard rules, right? This isn't a law. But the common sense of it all is just make sure we all have a good time out there and have fun. So let's slow down, smile, be safe.
Some of us have a natural way, though, of getting off a bike, so that's sometimes challenging. Real quick, talk to me a little bit more about the Crescent Trail. So it's for basically for people who ride the chairlift?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. Although I do want to say that Park City Mountain is actually footing half the bill with us. So really do appreciate that and kind of give them a kind of a high five out there for that. You know, this trail, the reason this trail was getting started was the Mojave is too difficult for a lot of people as a descent. It would be nice to have an alternative to just outright down to Jenny's and down. The other side of this, so the Crescent Trail, which will go from the Crescent Lift area approximately, go north and down to Mid-Mountain with the idea of connecting to Mid-Mountain. On a relatively gentle flow down only trail, once it's completed, the idea is to actually have Tommy's become one way up for bikes. And that'll take that lift traffic that has been going down Tommy's, hopefully redirect it over to the Crescent Trail and onto Mid Mountain and then Mid Mountain to Jenny's or whatever the other choices are at that point for them. But offer an alternative route. And that's why we're splitting this. I mean, if it was simply a lift issue, we would be asking PCM to basically pretty much foot the bill, and in all fairness, if it was a commercial venture for that side of life. In this case, it has a lot of public benefit in that we can kind of take a very busy portion of the trail system and try to add a little bit more directional management.
Okay. So this likely the last season for Tommy Two Step Down.
Yeah, good possibility. Yeah, and I think what you're going to see is that once again, like Armstrong, you're going to see less washboard, and hopefully, the turns on Tommy's really are relatively the switchbacks are relatively flat. They're not bermed like you would see on normal downflow trails. So having it be used in the way that it was really designed, it would be pretty much ideal.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, go out there, have fun. If you go up to the Uintas, though, it was pretty darn buggy. It's getting there. So, and I know that Rick said that he's been up on Bonanza Flat, starting to do some flagging up there as well. It's definitely is buggy. So this is a time of year where I think you want to start through making sure you have some insect repellent with you, long sleeves, that kind of stuff. Really makes a big difference.
Keep your mouth closed.
Yeah. Keep your mouth closed. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Charlie, have a good 4th. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Leslie.
As we reported, the board of directors for the Park City Ski and Snowboard Club have hired Park City resident John Kanarowski to lead the club. He joins me now in the studio along with one of the consultants to the club, Walt Evans. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so congratulations, John. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wanted the job.
Great. Well, and thanks so much for the congratulations and thanks for having us. Really appreciate the time. So I'm really excited. I think we've got a fantastic club here and a great tradition here in Park City around skiing and snowboarding, and really looking forward to contributing to the club and building on that tradition.
Okay. Well, you've got a pretty impressive background. You were a skier at Dartmouth?
Yeah, that's right. So I grew up in Germany. My dad was a U.S. Army officer, and we were stationed in Garmisch, Germany. So that's where I first got exposed to skiing. So grew up there, and then went to Dartmouth, and since then have been in the business world. And I'm really looking forward to kind of bringing that experience and bringing those skills to bear on the club and help the club continue on in its direction.
Yeah. So did you ski for the Dartmouth ski team?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
All right. So did you get any further than what Division I skiing?
That was if you will, the pinnacle of my skiing. And then I did afterwards, I moved out to California, and I this was in the mid 90s, and I did participate in a couple of the early extreme skiing competitions. So I had a lot of fun doing that as well.
So do you see that background in skiing more important to this job, or is kind of your business background and just being able to manage a lot of people and systems?
You know, great question. I think both are really important, right? So I think the business background will certainly help me contribute to the organization. And continue on our path there as an organization. But I think the sporting side helps as well to understand our athletes, understand the coaches and the culture around the different sports. And because that's ultimately our mission is helping these athletes. And so being able to bring both of those to the table, I think will hopefully help me have an impact in this role.
Yeah, Walt, so the board had to be thrilled to find a local boy to do this, yeah?
Well, you know, Jesse Hunt, our original ED, did a great job, Leslie, as he launched the club last October. Jesse has a nice foundation built for us, and we're proud of him moving on to the U.S. ski team. But I tell you, bringing John on right now in a timely fashion, and I congratulate the board of managers, Brent Nixon, the president, and then Jamie Preston, the search committee director. They expedited the process, and they had some very, very good candidates, went through a thorough process, and John emerged as a victor. I think there were 30 candidates. So, John, great to have you here, and timely in the summer so we can get ready for winter.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, we are just 1 year into the consolidation of the five youth programs under the new umbrella of Park City Ski and Snowboard. How did the first year go?
It was challenging. You know, Bill Rock, the president at Park City Mountain, challenged Jesse and I when we first launched the program. He said, guys, you need to be resilient and be patient and stay focused. But we got a lot of systems installed. And I think, Leslie, the real foundation of our club is the staff. We have an amazing management team, and we have an amazing coaching staff. And so John doesn't have to worry about that. John needs to worry about financial and governance and public relations and systems, business systems. So our staff's fantastic. And so I think we got that. And Jesse launched a couple of very important things.
Yeah, I think he did a lot of reining in, yeah?
Yes, he did.
We had very different management styles.
Diversity,
in terms of how
cultures were different, and it's coming together.
Yeah. So, John, I mean, you're obviously a fan of the program. You've got two kids in the program, a niece and a nephew as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've lived here in the area for 7 years, and so my kids are growing up here. And one of the reasons we moved out here from Denver was the fact that there is a club like this here, and that was really an important part of it. And our kids are coming up in the program. My niece and my nephew are coming up in it, and they've had great experiences, and they've really loved it. And so we as parents love it as well. And so I'm looking forward to seeing them progress and see what choices they make and see what paths they take through the clubs. The great thing about this is there are different ways they can go. So they're coming up on the Alpine side, but you know maybe they'll decide to move into one of the other programs. And I think that's a great thing of the integrated program, and it offers that flexibility and those choices to all of our athletes and families.
Yeah, given that you've had some immersion into how the program works, does that give you some insight then to how things could maybe be improved as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think like Walt was saying, there's a great culture, there's a great foundation in place. We have really strong coaches, so. I think that's great, and that's something we'll build on. I think the multi-sport aspect is really unique about our club, the breadth of sports that we cover, and there's a lot of research that shows that being exposed to a lot of different sports really helps athletes, and so I think we can really build on those assets, build on those strengths.
Yeah, and certainly because you know we brought in five different you know singly operated clubs to one. We have, of course, like the Park City Ski Team, who has its own team room. I don't think any of the other clubs kind of brought that to the table with them. So how do you solve something like that? I mean, is that just always?
In fact, Leslie, that's a good point. Let me comment on that, John. We do have a mogul and free ski and snowboard office right under the Alpine office, and it's a great facility. Team room down there, lockers, and some staff facilities. So those satellite offices really, really help us, and they're very important. Likewise, the Nordic program is based out of the Utah Olympic Park.
Okay. So everybody does have kind of a satellite place to put their skis and
you
boards
bet.
And mm-hmm. whatever else. Where do you operate from? From the Park City Mountain or from UOP?
I will be. So I'm starting on July 9th. So I will be operating out of the UOP.
Okay. And that's worked out well then, just for the staff?
That's worked out very well. Clearly, we're a little bit crowded, but the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation and the Utah Olympic Park have been very generous and very helpful to the club as we've gotten launched here.
Okay. Anything else you guys wanted to mention?
We, on July 4th, Park City Ski and Snowboard is working on the fun run, of course. Gail Barber at the Alpine Department's been behind that. And then we're going to have a giant parade. Hopefully many of our 800 young athletes will be in that parade, and your husband, Dar, will probably be out there with his flags and banners.
Oh, he's got the bike decorated, yeah.
So we'll be out in full force on July 4th.
Okay, we'll see you then. Thanks for your time.
Much.
And again, congratulations, John.
Thanks so much.
That's Walt Evans and John Kanarowski with Park City Ski and Snowboard Club. Well, as you have probably noticed, lots of work being done on the Kilby Frontage Road there as Summit County turns a former view area off of Interstate 80 into a 400-space parking lot. In the studio with me with an update on the project, I have Summit County Public Works Director Derek Radke. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the progress stunning on this park and ride project there. What I can't figure out is how this project jumped to the top of the to-do list. We've been talking about improvements to the Pine Brook and Jeremy Ranch exits since well before Bob Jasper was manager.
Yeah, the Jeremy project's been in the works, I hate to say it, but since 2006, I've been trying to get that thing built. I think I visited with you some time ago and telling you that it was my hope that the Jeremy project, the Ecker project, and the Kilby project would all be going at once, making one big mess and getting it done. But some design issues arose on the Jeremy project, just wetland mitigation, some structures design timing issues, things like that. So that project we still hope will kind of get started late fall, with some off-road, you know, utility relocations. There's one of the structures under the on-ramp, I believe, is outside the roadway. I hope that get that started. So anything that's outside the roadway, we're hoping that they get started on. And then the bulk of the construction will happen in 19, complete October of 19. That's the goal for now.
And I guess just without those exits done, and given the traffic that we already see there in that area, now we've got all of these cars coming off there and on there to access the park and ride. I mean, are we ever going to be able to make a left-hand turn off of the interstate?
Yes. And, you know, it's certainly not going to be ideal, but we don't expect the park and ride to fill day one, so it'll take some time, just like, you know, a new bus service or any other thing. It'll take time to get people using it. So I don't expect major traffic differences.
Okay. Who gets to park there? Anybody?
Anybody can park there. With our arrangement with the CVMA, they are funding a bulk of the projects, about $5.5 million worth, and they are the first hunt, well, they get 100 spaces to start with, and then there's another point in time when they get up to 200 spaces. And the project is designed so that there is an area that can be segmented off when that 200 spaces is needed. Right now, the CVMA is not wanting us to cordon that off right off, so it's basically open to anybody that wants to park and ride.
So they would have some kind of tag in their car then to
identify eventually
them?
Mm-hmm. How they decide to do that. I think that's one of the issues is, you know, do they use card access, some kind of transponder? You know, it'll all be built into the project. It just won't be active right away.
All right. And then so $5.5 million out of how much for a total project cost?
I can't remember the exact number. There's several hundred thousand that's still coming out of the transportation sales tax project monies.
Okay. So, I mean, is UDOT involved in any of it, or is it all county and CVMA?
The funding is all county and CVMA. UDOT has certainly been a great partner in that we've been able to work with them to reconfigure the truck thing so they get what they need for truck de-chaining and parking, and we get what we need for the park and ride.
So will it always be free parking?
as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. And once somebody gets to that lot, then what? I mean, where do they go?
So we intend to extend the Electric Express to the park and ride. So we expect 10-minute frequencies. I think we have to add a bus or two to maintain those headways, but it'll start at Park and Ride, go to the Kimball Junction Transit Center, back to the canyons, and on into Park City, just like it does today.
Okay. Let's see. You had made a presentation to the Park City Board of Education last week looking at the project. Of course, 400 parking spaces. We've got a tunnel that goes between the lot and Ecker Hill Middle School. Does it go right into the school, or does it just go into the where does the tunnel end?
It basically starts, it's in the right-of-way. We had to get 10 feet or 20 feet of extra right-of-way from the school district, and it starts just outside their back door, so to speak, where the kids currently, they walk out of the school at the end of the day, some of them, and they catch the public bus, and so they're crossing the existing road. And when we, you know, and on Friday, there can be 50-plus kids jumping on a bus, and we noticed that right away and decided that we didn't want them crossing surface-wise to catch the bus whenever they do it. So it's very near the school, but it's not inside the school.
Okay. So how long of a tunnel?
It's about 60 feet long or so.
It has
stairway and ramps on both ends.
All right. And then cameras inside, because that was...
Correct. So one of the issues was security. The tunnel will have cameras inside, and they'll be monitored both by the sheriff's department, and the school has asked that feed come into the office at the school, which we're happy to accomplish, and I haven't got that figured out yet, but technology can make it happen.
Okay. Let's see. You also will be doing or building two roundabouts, basically before and after the parking lot. Those are to do what?
So we had originally designed the project with one at the main entry to the school, and that was to kind of improve traffic flow. There's a lot of parent drop-off of kids, and so we wanted to make sure that everybody could get in and out efficiently, and so that was always planned there. And as we had also had issues, or the school district had talked about the buses having a tough time making a left out. So originally we said, well, they can make a right, go around the roundabout, and go back left. And that would make things a lot safer. They don't have to then dart out into traffic. And we were basically controlling the left in and left out. There was no left in and left out at that access. But as we looked at with the turning radiuses on the inside of the curbs for the buses, both the Park City Transit bus and the school buses, the size of that intersection was such that we could pretty much slap a circle right in the middle and have two roundabouts. And then now the buses have even greater flexibility. They can make a left by going right and around the roundabout and out. So the cost to actually do that was, you know, a few thousand dollars of concrete on the center of the lane. And that'll provide the maximum flexibility for traffic in and out. It will also, there were concerns about speeds in front of the school. You know, currently we have that nice flashing 25-mile-an-hour sign, but nobody drives 25. They won't be able to drive much more than 20 through the roundabout, so it'll improve safety in front of the school by reducing speeds.
Yeah, school buses and roundabouts, those seem like an oxymoron. I mean, are they large enough that a bus can maneuver?
Yeah, absolutely. We've designed it so they can zoom right around it.
Okay. So let's see. How is the project progressing? I mean, it looks like it's moving fast.
Staker has come in and they're not dilly-dallying around. They've come in and done a lot of work. They are already placing some of the subgrade materials for the truck parking area next to the freeway, and they'll be, you know, moving into, they'll be placing conduits and light bases. And as soon as they have that stuff placed in the park and ride lot area, they'll start, you know, graveling that area. They've already done the widening paving on Kilby Road. The next phase is they're putting curb and gutter along the trail side of the park of the Kilby Road. And as soon as that curb and gutter's in, they'll be paving that section up to about the fire station. So I would imagine in the next month or so, you'll see all that done. And then the center median stuff will start right after that.
Okay. So August 23rd is the scheduled done date?
No, it won't be done by school start, but we are hoping to have the majority of the traffic delays done, but still not sure.
Okay. And then was it just more cost effective to widen Kilby in just certain areas rather than just widening the entire road?
Well, widening the entire road doesn't accomplish everything that we're looking at. We couldn't get four lanes in there in the space available. So, again, we improved capacity by making improvements at the intersections. Some of the comments that we heard, well, just widening the road and making it, keeping it straight, is going to increase speeds, and we already have speed issues. So by making the improvements at the intersection, we've created this curvilinear type alignment that will encourage people to drive closer to the speed limit. It's also a median in the center, so it's more of a boulevard, and all of those things tend to have people drive more reasonable speeds. Bike lanes will also be on both sides, so the road will be wider, but given all those geometric features, we hope that people will maintain their speeds.
All right. And then the trail itself, the that's off the highway, that won't be impacted at all?
It's not. We're installing, ADA ramps at each of the intersections, but otherwise it's generally the same.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention about it, or what else you got going on this summer?
That's just the biggest project. We're out and about doing our overlay projects. Those projects, they've been out with the mills doing the edge work, so people should start seeing, new pavement in front of their places here soon. Just ask that people continue to be patient as they travel through Kilby area. Traffic control's been fairly good so far, but, have any comments or questions, feel free to call Public Works.
Okay. Hey, Derek, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Derek Radke is Public Works Director for Summit County. Well, Park City's former Emergency Services Manager Hugh Daniels was acknowledged at this week's Park City Council meeting for his service to Park City, first as a former council member himself, then as a emergency manager for the last 11 years. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So your service to Park City started well before your city council term, yeah? You served on the Park City Chamber
Bureau. We arrived
in
Park City in 1983. Almost 35 years ago, and opened the first full-time bed and breakfast inn up on Woodside, the old Miner's Lodge. And while we were doing that, I got involved with the Chamber Bureau. I was on the board of directors off and on for about 6 years. I was chairman, I think, maybe 91, 92, something like that. Spent a little time on the Historic Main Street Association at the time. Was the treasurer of Autumn Aloft for a number of years. Then there was a suggestion that I should run for city council, so I ran and lost. I ran and won. I ran and lost. So, but had 4 great years on council. It was a council that did a lot of things in town. You can blame us for paid parking. We started it. That was between 96 and 2000. We were preparing for the Olympics. We did the Flagstaff annexation, which is now Empire Pass. And then we sold the lodge in 2004. They did some consulting nationally, as well as some service projects and consulting projects for the city. And then one day I was having lunch with then City Manager Tom Backley, who said, we really haven't done anything with our emergency plan since the Olympics. Would you be interested? And before I came to Park City, I was the chief paramedic for the city of Pasadena in California. And I said, well, gee, that would be kind of fun probably to go back and into public safety. And so I took on that job actually just as a contract, and within 5 months I was the city's emergency manager.
And did that for 11 years.
For over 11 years, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the systems during those 11 years that you helped put into place.
We basically started from scratch. We did not have an emergency management program at all. We didn't have a emergency management plan. So one of the first things was developing our comprehensive emergency management plan, which is required under the National Incident Management System, under FEMA guidelines and congressional rules. So that was kind of the starting place. I did a little different than a lot of people. Our plan is only 32 pages long. It's not two big 4-inch binders, though I will admit the appendices are probably about another 400 or 500 pages. But that's the detail. So I wanted a plan that people could actually sit down and read in a relatively short period of time, because nobody's ever going to pick up a big book and work their way through it. From there, we went to develop the Emergency Operations Center, and we, you know, we're not busy enough or big enough to have a full-time one like some like Salt Lake or Salt Lake County. And we had just finished the public safety building. And so then Chief Lloyd Evans and I, along with Scott Robertson, our IT director, took that front training room and developed it into what I call an EOC on wheels. We can roll that up and put it together in about 30 minutes. And we've got that down to a fine science with a number of city staff who serve on the EOC management group and would fill those seats in a major emergency or disaster. And we exercise that all the time.
So when you talk about rolling it up, it's...
Everything's
it
on
mobile?
Carts and wheels. So lives in a closet that nobody has access to except only a few of us. Because you always want your stuff there when you need it, and you don't want to loan it out. So, yeah, there's probably half a dozen carts that are on wheels that rolls out, and all, including tables that are pre-wired. And now we've gone to wireless for all of our computers, and we'll be doing that with our phones. It's a lot more sophisticated than it was at first, but it's all color-coded, so you know exactly where it goes and where each piece goes, and everything is numbered, and so it makes it real easy to put it together.
Yeah, when you get up into the Uinta zone, none of that works. So what have you, I mean, if you were to go somewhere where you didn't have that service, what happens then?
Actually, we can take the EOC almost anywhere in the city where we have an Ethernet port. All I need is one Ethernet port, and we can set it up in pretty much any building that's in the city, anywhere from like the bus barn to City Hall to the library. You know, if you're going up in the Uintas, obviously that's not our jurisdiction, but we obviously help the county and have a mutual aid agreement with them. We have a mobile command trailer that obviously is smaller than the EOC, but it has most of the same types of equipment and radios and wireless. And so with the exception of getting onto the city network, we can pretty much run anything from that as well.
So we've got all this stuff ready to grow. Have we ever had to use it?
Well, we use the EOC pretty regularly for large special events. We did use the EOC for the H1N1 pandemic, the swine flu pandemic. While the lead agency was really the health department and the school district on that, neither one of them had an EOC. And we had actually just finished ours, so it was a good way to test it. So we provided EOC services for them on that. We didn't use it for the Rockport fire, the original Rockport fire, but we did provide a bunch of support to the county. So we went actually over and spent some time in their mobile command. Actually, for almost the whole week that fire was ongoing and that operation was ongoing. You know, emergency management, we're planners, really. We plan for the worst, hope for the best. I tell the council, you know, we're kind of like an insurance policy. You know, you got to have it, and you hope you never have to use it, but you're really happy if you do have to use it. And we evaluate the risks in the community and the hazards, and we need to develop our plans so that we can respond to any of those regardless of what they are. It's kind of called an all-hazards approach.
Yeah, and you and I have often talked about, I mean, the big one being the Salt Lake Fault and basically closing roads to Park City. And what would we do up here?
Yeah, we have two major risks. The primary one is wildfire. We are wildland urban interface, and as beautiful as it is and as green as it is, it could burn in a heartbeat. So that's the one we really truly worry the most. We've always worried about the earthquake because it's overdue. And, you know, a 7.0 in the valley is probably about a 5.6 for us up here, somewhere in that, 5.6, 5.8. Excuse me. Which for us is still a pretty good earthquake. But, you know, most of this town was built, you know, since the 70s. And most of it's wood construction, not unreinforced masonry. We'll lose facades on Main Street. We'll lose parapets. We'll have some chimneys fall off. But compared to the valley, our damage will be considerably less than what it would be down in the valley. Our problem is that they expect Interstate 80, Interstate 84, Utah 189, all to end up with landslides. And so we expect to pretty much be an island for, you know, anywhere from a few days to a few weeks. In the plan with Region 8 of FEMA, they will bring in equipment immediately to try to open up those corridors, because not only will they need to get supplies down into the valley, which will have significant damage, there are also major thoroughfares for the country for moving things from one end to the other. So that's why we always want the community to be prepared. The city is pretty well prepared. Our individual citizens need to be prepared, because when you talk to our managers at our local markets, if their 18-wheelers aren't coming in to restock, they predict their shelves will be empty in 48 to 72 hours.
Wow. So you have you send out, I think, emergency pamphlets to the public.
Yeah, we do an outreach at least every year, as well as certainly coming on KPCW and talking about things that are happening in the community. We give lots of presentations throughout the community to various groups that want us to talk about preparedness or what the potential hazards are in the community and what they can do.
Okay. Well, we hope it doesn't happen, but we'll thank you if it does for,
well, thank
for
you.
Putting it into place.
You know, Mike McComb is the new emergency manager. He grew up in Park City, went to school in the Marsac building, went to school in the library building. Brings a lot of experience from his time in the Navy. He'll be doing a great job, so there is another emergency manager now that's available to take over.
Okay, so what are you planning to do?
I'm not going to work quite as hard. I still am the treasurer for the International Association of Emergency Managers, which is our large international association of about 5,000 to 6,000 members. So that's going to continue while I'm involved in their certification commission, which is kind of the gold standard for emergency managers. And I've been asked to do some teaching for the state and for FEMA, but it'll be on a very part-time basis. I call it semi-retired. We're going to – my wife, Susan Nguyen, who works for the city as well, be retiring in October. I owe her a lot of trips from things I've done when she wasn't able to go. So there's payback time coming, but a fair amount of it will be reading and putting my feet up and enjoying everything that's around us and not working just quite as hard.
Okay. Well, again, thanks, Sue.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:52. That's outgoing Emergency Services Manager Hugh Daniels.